Cassette 9, Side 2.
Chapter 70. Hikaki. The need to run quietly kept her speed to little more than it might have been with a sled. It was frustrating. Cut off from contact with anyone for more than a day, Hikaki studied the seascape around her to avoid thinking about the possible fate of Crydike and Streaker. She would find out what had happened sooner or later. Until then, worry would only wear her out. Morning light filtered down to the canyon bottoms as she swung east and then northward. Clots of dangleweed drifted overhead, and copper-backed fish darted briefly alongside until the driving skiff left them behind. Once she caught sight of something long and sinuous that quickly slithered into a sea cave as she approached. There was no time to stop and explore, but she did take the monster's picture as she passed. What will I do if I find Streaker destroyed? The thought came unwanted. I'll go back to the Thenon and wreck as an intermediate step. They'd need me there, but I'd be commander then, and hiding at the bottom of the ocean wouldn't be a long-term solution, not on this deadly world. Can I bring myself to negotiate a surrender? If she did, she wouldn't let the Galactics take her personally. She was one of the few who, with the right notes, could plot an accurate course back to the derelict fleet. Maybe I'd see the crew safely interned and then make a break for it in the skiff, she thought. Not that the skiff could ever make it all the way home, even if it could run a galactic blockade. But someone has to try to get word back to Earth. Perhaps there would be a way to punish the fanatics, make their behavior so costly to them that they'd think twice before bullying Earthlings again. Hikaki knew she was dreaming. In a few thousand years, humans and their clients might have that kind of power. Maybe. Hikaki listened. There was a sound. She turned up the gain on the ship's hydrophones. Filters removed the background growl of the engines and the tide. She heard the soft scurrying sounds of the ocean creatures. Computer, filter for cetacean output. The patterns of sound changed. The sea became quiet. Still, there was a trace of something. Increase gain. The noise level rose. Above the static hiss, she heard the faint but distinguishable cries of swimming dolphins. They were desperate sounds of combat. Was she picking up the echoes of straggling survivors of a disaster? What to do? She wanted to rush to the aid of the distressed Fen, but who was pursuing them? Machine sounds, she commanded. But the detector winked a red light, indicating that there were none within range. So the dolphins were sledless. If she attempted a rescue, she risked the only hope of the crew back at the Seahorse. Should she make a detour around the refugees and hurry toward Streaker as planned? It was an agonizing choice. Hikaki cut her speed to run still quieter and sent the skiff due north toward the dim cries. Chapter 71. Charles Dart. He waited until everyone had left before he unscrewed the back of the new robot and checked its contents. Yes, it was still there, safely concealed. Ah, well, he thought, I'd hope to repeat the experiment, but one bomb should be enough. Chapter 72. Streaker. From the Journal of Gillian Baskin. We're on our way. Everyone aboard seems relieved to be moving at last. Streaker lifted off the ocean floor late last night, impellers barely ticking over. I was on the bridge monitoring reports by the Fen outside and watching the strain gauges until we were sure Streaker was okay. In fact, she sounded positively eager to be off. Emerson and the crew in the engine room should be proud of the job they've done. though of course it's the coils Tom and Tisht found that made it possible. Streaker hums like a starship once again. Our course is due south. We dropped a monofilament relay behind to keep us in touch with the party on the island, and left a message for Hikahi when she shows up. I hope she hurries. Being a commander is more complicated than I'd ever imagined. I have to make sure everything is done in the right order and correctly, and all as unobtrusively as possible, without making the Fen feel the old lady is hovering over them. It makes me wish I had some of the military training Tom got while I was away in medical school. Less than 30 hours and we'll reach the Thenanin shell. Suessi says they'll be ready for us. Meanwhile, we have scouts out, and Wadasetti paces us overhead in a detection sled. His instruments show very little leakage, so we should be safe for now. I'd give a year's wages for Hikahi or Tisht or even Kipiru right now. I'd never understood before why a captain treasures a good executive officer so much. Speaking of captains, ours is a wonder. Crydike seemed to be in a daze for a long time after getting out of sickbay, but his long conversation with Saud appears to have roused him. I don't know what Saud did, but I would never have believed a person so severely damaged as Crydike could be so vigorous or make himself so useful. When we lifted off, he asked to be allowed to supervise the scouts and flankers. I was desperate for a reliable Finn to put in charge out there, and thought that having him visible could help morale. Even the Stenos were excited to have him about. Their last bitterness over my coup and Takata Jim's exile seems to have dissipated. Crydike is limited to the simplest calls in Trinary, but that seems to be enough. He's out there now, zipping about in his sled, keeping things orderly by pointing, nudging, and setting an example. In only a few hours, Tisht should rendezvous with the scouts we sent ahead, and then Crydike can come back aboard. There's a tiny light on my comm that's been flashing since I returned. It's that crazy Timbrimi NIS machine. I've been keeping the damn thing waiting. Tom wouldn't approve, I guess. But a femme has only so much strength, and I've got to take a nap. If the matter were urgent, it would have broken in and spoken by now. Oh, Tom, we could use your endurance now. Are you on your way back? Is your little glider even now winging home to Toshio's island? Who am I fooling? Since the first psi bomb, we've detected nothing. Only noise from the space battle, some of it indicating fighting over his last known position. He's set off none of the message globes, though either he's decided not to send an ambiguous message, or worse. Without word from Tom, how can we decide what to do once we enter the Seahorse? Do we take off and try our luck, or hide within the hulk as long as we can? It will be Hikahi's decision when the time comes. Jillian closed the journal and applied her thumbprint to the failsafe self-destruct. She got up and turned off the light. On her way out of the lab, she passed the stasis bier of the ancient cadaver they had reclaimed at such cost from the shallow cluster. Herbie just lay there grinning under a tiny spotlight, an ancient enigma, a mystery, a troublemaker. Battered, battle-scarred Streaker moved slowly along the valley floor, her engines turning over with gentle, suppressed power. A dark, foamy mist rose below her, where impellers kicked up the surface ooze. The nubby cylinder slid over gloomy black rills and abysses, skirting the edges of seamounts and valley walls. Tiny sleds paced alongside, guiding the ship by sonar speak. Crydike watched his ship in motion once again. He listened to the clipped reports of the scouts and sentries and the replies of the bridge staff. He couldn't follow the messages in detail. The sophisticated technical argot was as out of reach to him as last year's wine, but he could sense the undermeaning. The crew had things well in hand. Streaker couldn't really shine in this light, dim and blue, 50 meters down.